Welcome to Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden, the podcast where we explore the dark depths of literature. We are your hosts, Tim Tresh and
Joaquin Lobo.
And we're here to talk about the books that scare us, the books that make us think, and the books that just plain weird us out. So whether you're looking for a good scare, a thought-provoking read, or just something to keep you up at night, we've got you covered. But be warned, this podcast is not for the faint of heart. We're going to be talking about some dark and disturbing stuff. If you're ready to go on a journey into the dark depths of literature, then join me every week for a new episode of Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden. Make that 2 or 3 weeks. And remember, if you hear something that makes you want to sleep with the lights on, that's a good thing, because that means we're doing our job. God. Joaquin, how are you?
You're just doing this such a beautiful way, my dear Tim Tresh. Now I'm afraid to say anything after what you just said.
I know, it has to be very dark and disturbing.
It'd be really scary. I know.
Yeah.
I'm good. I got a good scare. I'm just coming back from New York City, and I saw a rat in Central Park, and I saw a rat in the subway. So the Big Apple did not disappoint. It met my expectations.
That's good.
Yeah, that was really the only scary thing that I saw coming from Oakland and San Francisco. I was completely confused because the city is so clean and pristine and nice and civilized wherever I went. It's a mess, obviously. Lots of people, lots of noise, lots of traffic. But in general, compared to San Francisco and Oakland, it's just great.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Maybe I didn't go to the places that, you know, normal, everyday New Yorkers go, but I found it a lot more pleasant than San Francisco and Oakland.
Huh. I've never heard anyone say that. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there are no tents everywhere. You know, I take a walk around Lake Merritt and there are tents. Yeah. Homeless people living right by the lake, and they seem to be pretty comfortable. They own, you know, very valuable real estate there on the lake. Nobody messes with them. There's piles of trash everywhere you go.
Yeah.
I didn't see any of that in Central Park. You know, and it's a huge place. Not a single tent. But I also think that, you know, we love to, I don't know, maybe our guest, let me introduce him in a second. He will call my bullshit. But I think that we love to think of ourselves as, you know, as victims of the, you know, we live in this terrible place and this is awful and there is so much crime and this place is not safe. And I've heard that pretty much in every city that I visit. Oh God, it's so unsafe. I don't feel safe going out at night and there is a lot of crime and blah, blah, blah. But in reality, I feel that some places are seriously unsafe, like Mexico or Ukraine, to think of the most violent places on earth. We just think of them as dangerous in general.
Well, and they kind of are. I mean, I don't know exactly what their parameters were, but I read in a totally different context something recently that made me go, huh, because I was looking up something about Uruguay. And on some big organization's peace index, Uruguay, of 163 countries, is number 35. I mean, so good. The U.S. is number 121.
So, what's the ranking related to?
To crime.
Oh wow!
Yeah, no. And so it's.
So you mean that Uruguay is more dangerous than the U.S. or safer than the U.S.?
Safer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But they have no water now. You know, that's the big news in Uruguay. Montevideo has no water. They ran out of water.
I know.
So they're very safe, but they don't have water.
But I also heard that was weird that to me, I mean, like, because like there's a certain sort of prejudice sort of against Latin American water that Uruguay has actually safe drinking water, usually. I mean, now there's a drought and they don't have the salty, gritty water, but usually you can actually drink that water safely. And also, it's one of the most progressive countries. I have to admit that I was a little lacking in knowledge about Uruguay, but they allow same-sex marriage, abortions. They're way more progressive than America at this point.
Yeah, let's visit Uruguay. It's the best country on the planet, Uruguay.
Yeah, let's all move to Uruguay.
Let me recommend now, before I forget, those of you who speak Spanish, there is this show on YouTube called Tiranos Temblad. That's the best show that I can recommend enough, because it's just fantastic. It's so funny, and it's so witty, and it's so smart. Tiranos Temblad. I'll remind the audience of the show at the end of today's episode. But let me also introduce our guest.
Yes.
I'm very excited, very happy to welcome today a friend, a young man that I met many years ago when he was a student at CCA in Oakland. He was never my student. He refused to take any classes with me, which is something that I also like very much, someone who didn't want to take any classes with me, but he's my friend. And maybe he'll tell me why now. And then when he graduated from the Writing and Literature program, he went to New York City, to NYU, where he got a master's in cultural reporting and criticism from NYU. And he became a photographer. He attended a very prestigious workshop, the Eddie Adams Workshop of Photojournalism. He also became the co-founder and editor of a local New York publication called Laid Off New York. He writes fiction and he translates. He's published his fiction in the Rumpus and in the British magazine La Picholeta Barca. And he's currently working, which is very exciting, on the translation into English of the work by a great Mexican poet, Francisco Hernandez, whom I met a lifetime ago in Mexico. He's definitely a really talented Mexican poet. So Guillermo Manning, welcome to Foreign Domestic and Forbidden.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I didn't know you met Francisco Hernandez. That's great news.
Long time ago. Yeah, we're not friends. We met a couple of times.
Many. You know everyone. Every time I bring up a writer, you're like, oh yeah, I met him a lifetime ago in some, you know, bar somewhere. Yeah.
No, I think we just had coffee. I don't think he drinks, Francisco Hernandez. Does he drink?
I have no idea.
But you know Francisco, right? You met him through this
process. I've talked to him, yes, but there's a lot of alcohol in his work, so I'm surprised that he doesn't drink.
Well, maybe, I don't know. He wrote a book on a collection of poems on Robert Schumann. Remember that?
Yeah. It's the one it's the second part of the book that I'm translating.
It's beautiful. That's
and how Robert Schumann was defeated by the demons.
The demons. Yeah, that was the title of the book, The Demons of Robert Schumann, or something like that. It's really great poetry. Looking forward to seeing that in English, Guillermo.
Yeah, me too. It's really exciting. But thank you for having me. And I'm surprised that you said that that Manhattan is clean.
Yeah, well, that was my impression. Have you been to San Francisco lately?
I have not. And I usually get that question from people who have been to both places. They're like, well, which one do you prefer? Which one is dirtier for you?
No, I called it pristine, not clean. I said pristine compared to San Francisco and Oakland.
Oh my God, but how's San Francisco lately? I mean,
it's a mess. What do you think, Tim?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't been to New York in a long while, so I don't know what the comparison might be. I don't know. I think right now San Francisco is more, I don't know. It's in a sad state of being, just because people have left the inner city and it's emptier. I think a lot of the life that used to be there is currently not there. And that might change, I don't know, quickly or not so quickly. But And we have a huge unhoused problem. Rents are way too expensive here. Whether it's clean or not clean, it's expensive to live. That's also a national problem, which is also funny. Like even the places that I knew to be relatively cheap are not cheap anymore. So America's homeless problem will become bigger just because people don't know how to make ends meet. And frankly, I'm often shocked to see how expensive life around here is, and especially when I imagine being maybe a 24-year-old out of college looking for a job that's not in the tech sector. And how do you make ends meet? I don't know. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy to start in such an expensive environment. Back in Berlin, when I grew up, I mean, you could score an apartment which wasn't great, or it still had a coal oven and all that, but you could score it really cheap. Rent was not a problem. And now just making rent is just horrendous. So whether it's clean or not, I don't know, but living is expensive.
Yeah, no, I remember, I think it was Fran Lebowitz, I heard her saying this some time ago, that when you ask people in New York, how do they pay the rent? Nobody knows, like not even the rich. It's so expensive that people just don't know, they just do it. And there is something to that, I mean. It's a mystery.
Yeah. So we're talking a lot about Manhattan and New York in this podcast, we decided to focus on the literature in New York, coming out of New York, dealing with New York, what the subgenres might be, what stands out, what's especially New Yorkian or not. And yeah, so I'm super happy to have you here as a part-time New Yorker, part-time Mexico City-er, to also think about what are the differences in how we treat New York in literature versus other cities, if there are differences, or if it's just another big city with a lot of literature about it.
That's an interesting point of departure. Is it just another big city?
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking sort of in preparation and research for the pod that, of course, Berlin has a lot of literature about itself. If you go back, there's a lot of famous and semi-famous and notorious novels about the place, movies, of course, too. But I've always looked at New York a bit differently, A, because it's also the center of the literary market in America, and B, because as a hub for immigration, as a hub for coming to the new world with all the expectations of finding a different or better life. I think New York, maybe at least in the Western world, might be without rival, but prove me wrong.
No, I don't think in that sense it has a rival. I mean, just comparing it to Mexico City, for instance, I think that the origin of the sort of literary image that we have of Mexico City is almost archaeological. We begin with the historical documents of the pre-Columbian cultures, and then the conquest, and then you keep building on that. And it's sort of, whenever you write about, I feel like when writers write about Mexico City, they somehow always go down. Or they go down the layers of history in some way, and then they go back to the surface over the time they're writing about. And I think that New York doesn't have that. I mean, there are writers who have explored the past, but it's usually the literature. I mean, the novels that have marked the city are always present. They're almost always trying to get a picture of what's happening in the present. And in that sense, that's I think we have very good novels about immigration and novels about the city changing in the early, late 19th century, early 20th century, and, you know, the 60s and even today. And it's a different way of writing. And I don't think writers feel the need to go back and dig or discover something in the past. They're always looking for the present and even to the future. That's usually the difference that I feel. Just again, comparing it with Mexico City. I don't know what you think, Juan. Do you agree with this?
I love that. I think that's so true in so many different ways that, in a sense, you can't get rid of your past as a Mexican writer, even if you want to. You have to sort of address the past in order to make sense of the present. And I don't feel that you need to do that. In general, in the U.S., like, everything is so moving so fast and it's so overwhelming that thinking of the past becomes kind of a symptom of nostalgia, and it soon becomes irrelevant. Nostalgia, it doesn't have a lot of use in American fiction. We don't like to think of ourselves as obsessed with the past, and we're always looking forward. I don't know enough about New York, and I don't know enough about New Yorker literature to assess what people are doing there. But I do see it as that center that Tim is sort of profiling with what he said. I think that there is so much, not just because of the fact that all the major publishing houses are in New York, in the American market, of course, but it also has very deep connections to the other markets in Europe in particular. And there is a sense that what happens in New York is what is happening everywhere, that they own the present moment, and they own some kind of relevant truth about the present. It's not just the publishing houses, but also the media. And you have, you know, the major networks, all the major newspapers, New York Times, etc., New Yorker, all the publications that sort of create opinion, public opinion, and public perception of present history. Everything is there.
And the theater,
a theater. I mean, I'm not a theater person, but yes, that's also there.
Yeah.
The movies and I mean, there are festivals. You know, the Europe has its own festivals, but still, New York, I feel, remains like a hub for cinema and for music. And I mean, yeah, that is one of the things that it's incredible about New York. That it just the amount of things that are happening every day is unbelievable. You know, the opera is like, you know, having something incredible, and then there is all the sports that are happening, and you go to, when you go to the subway, like when you're coming back, you start seeing people coming out of this events, and everyone has had a great experience, and they all just saw the best thing in the world, and right. Everything is different. You know, that is something that I don't think happens anywhere else in the world. Maybe London.
I mean, you come from a big city, from Mexico City, my town also. I think it's, you know, a very easy process to adapt yourself to New York coming from a place like that. It feels very natural, but at the same time, the difference are enormous.
Yeah, I mean, no, the main difference, I think, is exposure, but the interaction of cultures in New York. It's very interesting because you have everything. I mean, everyone from everywhere in the world is there, but they're not. But they're there, and they remain in their own cultures. So if you go to Chinatown, for instance, or if you go to you know, parts of Queens where you only hear Spanish and you only hear Chinese and you only hear Italian is less so now, but you know, there are, I think that is a difference. And I think that's something that I'd never experienced, not even in San Francisco or in Oakland. This kind of real exposure to culture that is not sort of mediated by anything, really. It's just your interaction with it. And yeah, that is something that I don't think it takes some time to adapt. I think it takes some time to really process that people have been living there for generations, and they have, you know, they are New Yorkers, really. I mean, they're not Americans in that sense, that they have gone out and like become Americans in the sort of they have that adapted to the American culture. They have remained, you know, they have preserved their own heritage and their own culture and their own language, and they use it and they live with it, and New York like allows them to do that. I mean, you know, to go to a restaurant and go to, I don't know, a bodega and speak their language, and you know,
and we don't have anything like that in Mexico City. We don't have, I mean, I lived in Buenos Aires. You don't have anything like that in Buenos Aires. These are big, massive cities, but they, mm-hmm. we don't have that. What you're describing is not, is very different from what we have in other places.
There's a really cool book. It's called Jekyll, A Tale of the New York Ghetto. It's from 1896. The book has never become super famous, but there was a 1975 film, Hester Street, and it talks about Jewish immigrants and the kind of community you, Guillermo, was just talking about, we're just talking about, that I think for the immigrants, it appears very American, but yet for any visitor to it, it would feel very insular and still like the old world culture, and sort of at that fault line, sort of the whole book and the movie sort of move along, sort of trying to integrate the new and the old, but showing the old making a stand in the new world, preserving itself, but at the same time also becoming a vital part of this new world. And yeah, and I think that's something that, I don't know, you see parts of that in Los Angeles, but it's different mm-hmm. there. It doesn't have the same feel. And I'm not sure it's, to me, it seems hard to describe what exactly is different, but because of course you have all these neighborhoods, Little Armenia and Chinatown too, but it doesn't feel quite as insular or as preserved as in New York.
Yeah, I mean, I think people, I mean, this is well known, but people in New York have the tendency to assert themselves. They don't really ask for permission to do things, and there is something to that about this. I think that no one is trying to please anyone, and so if you don't have to please anyone, you're going to, you know, you're going to defend your own way of living, and you're going to defend mm-hmm. and preserve your own way of, you know, interacting with your family and speaking your language and then cooking the way you cook and all of this. And I think, yeah, it is different from everywhere in the world, I would say. But it has that sort of feeling of like, we're not asking for permission. I mean, we're here and we're going to assert and that's it. I mean, you know, yeah. And yeah, our neighbors are different, and you know, we don't even say hi to each other sometimes, but we live together, and we don't even have to like each other, but we're going to live in this place together. I mean, this tiny place, and you know, that's, I mean, I think that's a model of multiculturalism that is very successful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, so there's also the tale. So when I sort of did research, of the young person coming to New York, trying to make it. And there are some tales where the person makes it, but more often than not, I think the books that remain are the books where people are not really making it. So Bright Lights, Big City, or even further back, The Great Gatsby, where people like endow New York with this magic and then find out that it might not be exactly their magic or the magic they have been hoping for.
Right.
Yeah. And that takes up, I think, a huge part of the literature in terms of what it means like for Americans or people born in the United States who look at New York, who have been raised in Kansas or in Minnesota, and what it means to see it on the screen constantly held up as this shining beacon of civilization. This is where things are happening. And then coming to that as a kind of coming of age story.
Yeah, I was thinking of Lovecraft, who...
Oh my God.
Well, he hated foreigners, you know? He was a racist, of course. He hated everyone who was white and Anglo-Saxon. And some of the most interesting postcards of Lovecraft's time in New York come from stories where he talks really nasty terms about immigrants and about Asians, Chinese in the streets of New York, making them filthy and dangerous. And that resounds so much right now with national level politics, where you have people like George Abbott in Texas or DeSantis in Florida trying to sort of recreate a position where every immigrant and every person of color is dangerous and poses some kind of risk to the old myth of the American innocence. That, you know, there is always so much tension between that idea of American innocence versus the danger from abroad or the danger from represented by the outsider. And when was Lovecraft writing those stories? You know, it's like no matter how much time passes, that even in places like, and I don't know, like right now, what's New York like for a young immigrant from Central America or Africa, but I feel that there is always this tension in between the outsider and the native.
Mm-hmm.
And some places more than other. I feel like In New York, you get yourself lost, and people, you know, place is so big that everybody has dark hair, for instance, and that's something that's interesting. And you look around, and you know, you get yourself lost in the middle of this ocean of natives and immigrants, and you don't even listen a lot of English on the streets. Everybody's speaking a different language. So it's probably more difficult to be harassed, to become an object of harassment in a place like New York than in other places where you're obviously a foreigner, like, I don't know, the Midwest or other places. But do you feel that New York is still a place that's suspicious of the outsider, like Guillermo?
I have to say I don't feel that. I mean, obviously, there are always people out there who are going to, you know, react in this way. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's general, like, I don't know, the vibe, if you want to use the word, in of the city. I think that, no, I mean, just the people that I know, I've never, you know, people from really all over the world, students and you know, journalists and so on, who come to New York and... you know, it's not that they feel at home, because it's very difficult to feel at home in New York. As you said, it's being so big and so challenging, and, you know, you don't really matter. Like, whatever you're doing, you know, another 100 people are trying to do it. And so you're really there for the competition. I mean, people that come to New York at this point, I think that they either have a project and they're very concrete about their goals and they know what they want, or they've dreamed about New York for, you know, their entire lives, and, you know, they have this fantasy about the city and they want to live there.
Did you have that fantasy, Guillermo?
No. No, I didn't.
But you go back every time. You're always there. Now.
Yeah, I mean, because it's very hard to live. I mean, this is one of the, that's the John Didion essay, the goodbye to all that. I mean, when she's saying goodbye to New York and she didn't really leave New York. it is hard to live in New York because, there is this intensity. There is this sort of, and you have that, you really are with the best people. I mean, you don't know, if you're a writer, if you're a photographer, if you're, finance people, and these are kind of people, you are with the best in the world. I mean, and they're there to do the same thing that you want to do. And that sort of community, it can become unhealthy in the sense that you're just there to prove a point, and that even if you're failing, as we were talking about.
Are you in a constant competition with your peers?
Yeah, it can become very, even toxic at times, but no, I mean, I think that if you have an ambition, New York can be welcoming in that sense. I mean, it welcomes the ambition, right, regardless of where you come from. And yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's more than just openness and, we're very good people. It's like, we don't care. there is indifference more than, an open heart or something. Which again can be very challenging and, brutal even. I mean, I know a lot of people who after 6 months said, I can't live here. People from California, from San Francisco who went back. I mean, I was like, no, I mean, this is too much for me.
I can see that. I can totally see that.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is my experience. I don't know. Maybe someone else can tell you something different, but this is the way I see it. And yeah, I definitely don't feel that people are suspicious of outsiders. In fact, I mean, you just walk down the city and you see all kinds of things. Like, people are really not afraid of expressing themselves in New York. I mean, the fashion, for instance, if you look at the fashion in New York, it really is the place where people display their most, like, the craziest ideas, and they walk down the street and people are like, saying you look great, or they don't care. Those are the two reactions that you get.
I saw a lot of Barbies walking around last week.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's
and they look great. I don't know if they could walk like that in San Francisco. They were like really out there, these girls wearing their Barbie outfits, because of the premiere of the Barbie movie, of course.
Yeah, and the reaction that, I mean, usually the reactions that you get is, you look fantastic, or, I don't care. Like, I don't know what this is.
Yeah, no one seems to care, actually. You don't even look at them because you don't.
Yeah, exactly. You just keep walking. I mean,
I read at some point that it's hard to write a horror story about New York. And the only example that the writer was giving us was Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby. And I was wondering about that. We have tons of crime novels, from Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man to Susanna Moore's In the Cut. But are you aware of any more sort of New York horror, or what the horror would actually be? In Rosemary's Baby, it's of course the Antichrist being born. But is there a specific horror to living in New York, other than cockroaches and rats and all that?
Well, I was going to say that Lovecraft tried to write horror about New York. I mean, it was more about his own phobias and paranoias and all of that, but I think he tried. it's a good question. I mean, I'm sure there is. I mean, because, it's just a matter of looking, searching for it. But I would say that it would be very difficult to write horror about New York, honestly. in the supernatural sense, I mean.
Yeah, like, yeah,
and Rosemary's Baby, I don't even think that it's like a reference for the city or anything like that. I feel, or is it? I don't think that people think of, like, what a book to read about New York, and they think Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, there's only the apartments, and that it was filmed there. And in the book, it's the Bramford, and then
the Dakota building. Yeah,
yeah.
In that John Lennon's building, that's where he got.
He died there. So he got us going into the building. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Horror and a city that, you know, it's Gotham. I mean, it's perfect for horror, right? So I'm wondering if your friend Joyce Carol Oates might have written horror set in New York.
I was thinking about that.
She's a New England horror story. So there must be something.
There must be, although she always writes more about the countryside. I feel she grew up obviously in a farm and so on. So, and in the cities that she's written about, it's mostly Detroit. I feel like the Wonderland and
yeah, them, right.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know. I mean, you should know, Juanel. You're very... You're the fan of horror here.
I don't know. I have to...
Are there any vampires in New York? I don't know. Anne Rice didn't write something?
No, that's more New Orleans. Anne Rice writes from about the South.
Yeah.
If you want, you can maybe give a nod to American Psycho as a modern horror novel.
Yeah, that's good. That's pretty good. American Psycho.
Yeah, not as a supernatural horror, but as horror novel nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, because crime, I think, is I mean, the noir genre has, I think it goes better with New York.
Right.
And I mean, yeah, it's like the capital of noir. I mean, there is this, I don't know if you know this, this place, the mystery bookstore in Tribeca, and it's the publishing house of Otto Penzler, and it's the bookstore just dedicated for crime
fiction,
and they have everything. I mean, it's a beautiful place. I think it's one of the most beautiful bookstores that I know, and it's only crime fiction, and they're constantly publishing new crime novels and short stories, and they do these incredible anthologies of the most specific kind of genre, like subgenres of crime. You know, the people who died with, you know, a bullet and a knife or something, and then, you know, stories about that. I think that I don't know, like the genre, the detective story lends itself to explore the city in a way that I don't think horror can reach. Like a writer like Jerome Charon, for instance, who is barely known, who has explored the Bronx, like I mean, he knows the Bronx better than anyone, and it is through the detective story. I mean, very sort of sarcastic.
Even, I'm thinking Colson Whitehead, what he's done lately with Harlem. That's super interesting.
Yeah, so that's what I would like suggest in as a substitute for horror, the noir. I think it's a fantastic genre, and you know, it's not taken very seriously sometimes, which I always regret.
Yeah, I don't know. I think lately there's been a great deal of appreciation for crime fiction and the noir in ways that, you know, traditionally it hasn't. I think that the sense that serious writers can also come from crime fiction and noir, not just from literary fiction, even horror. I mean, you have really, really good writers playing with, you know, genre fiction.
Yeah, you just mentioned Colson Whitehead, and he has also the Zone One book, which is a zombie novel.
Right, zombie novels or science fiction, right? The like science fiction, the Underground Railroad. You can say that Colson Whitehead isn't a serious, fine writer. He's already got Pulitzer Prizes. Really, really great one.
I mean, Paul Auster. I mean, you.
Yeah, you have a big fan of Paul Auster here with Tim Trash Loves Paul Auster.
The early Paul Auster.
The early Paul Auster.
Yeah, the New York trilogy, where he mixes literary criticism and the detective novel, the noir, which is kind of like this odd but compelling mixture of the very literary aspects of New York with its underbelly and marrying those two.
Yeah, and it's also very... I was reading recently something that I found very interesting. I don't know if you've read this, Juvenal. The Argentinian writer Ricardo Piglia, who also was very interested in crime fiction and genre fiction in general. I was reading an interview of him, and he said that for him, the literary critic is like a detective. That the literary critic is reconstructing something when he's reading a text, and most of the times he's reconstructing his life through the text that he's reading or through the texts that he's reading. And also, obviously, this is a very sort of like reminiscent of Borges and so on. But it is all I find that the crime, like Spallastro does, the crime genre also lends itself to a lot of dialogue with literature itself, because it's always making reference to a genre that it's already established and writers that are well known, and it's always a dialogue. I feel. I mean, crime writers are always like, oh yeah, this is based on this novel by, you know, Dwight, MacDonald, I forgot his name, his first name.
John MacDonald?
Yeah, sorry, Dwight MacDonald is the critic, sorry. or Hammett, I like that very much, that sort of connection and conversation between the genre, within the genre, in crime fiction, and Pallastro is obviously a great example.
Even Piglia's most famous book, or his best-selling book, was Plata Quemada, which is a heist story. It's a crime story. And well, the other books, you know, people would say that are much more sophisticated and literary. I think that even the fact that Piglia wanted to write a crime fiction book says something about the appeal of this type of story.
It might also be for big city dwellers, very close to the experience everyone has when they leave their apartments in the morning and join the masses. You're basically shadowing people, following them for a little while. You observe what's going on. You try to make sense of your observations. If you live in a big apartment building, you see glimpses of people. You imagine what's behind the doors. Maybe somebody leaves the door open once in a while and you can see a bit of the life. And in some sense, everybody living in a big city who's not from there, hasn't grown up there, becomes a detective in finding out what's going on around them, how that makes sense, how these pieces fit together. And so maybe detective fiction in big cities is very close to the experience of the flaneur, the person who just walks up and down the avenues, looks at things, takes in, makes quick observations, small judgments, and spends their whole day just observing things, being a detective of sorts.
Just reminded of Hitchcock, The Rear Window.
Yeah.
You know, the perfect example of curiosity and checking out what the neighbors are doing. And that set, I just check on my phone. That's set in New York in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
It's a great Hitchcock feel from 1955 or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, it's like the mystery of the neighbor, the mystery of what's going on in the window across from your place. I love that.
Yeah, when something just becomes too big to be well known. So in smaller towns, you have the reverse problem that you know way too much and have to keep quiet about it if you want to keep the peace. Whereas in big cities, you always have the feeling you know way too little about what's going on everywhere around you, and everything feels potentially threatening. Weird noises at night, loutish neighbors. I once lived above the fringe. He was some martial arts champion. And so in the middle of the night, so 2 o'clock in the morning, he would do exercises. It would be really, really loud. And so like I would go down and say, hey, keep it down, you know. And one time he opened the door and I was like, whoa. And he invited me in. And then just out of nowhere, he was wearing jeans and some shirt. He went into a split just out of like this. And just like, it was amazing. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was weirded out. But he was the French kickboxing champion. Yeah. And so he ended up in the apartment below me. And so like you always expect these things to happen. And they're kind of, of course, the fun of a big city, that people who don't really, quote unquote, belong together have to live together and make sense of their strange encounters.
Yeah, isn't that the premise of Rosemary's Baby? I mean,
yeah.
Come to this apartment and they happen to be neighbors with the satanic
cult. The satanic coven, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. It makes perfect sense.
How do you feel about Oakland, Juvenal? Do you think that... because in Oakland, I also felt something like this. I mean, in a smaller scale, obviously, but I remember walking, I don't know, Telegraph Avenue or College Avenue and looking at these little tiny windows with the lights on at 3 a.m. and I was like, what is happening there? Like, why do these people have the lights on at 3 a.m? And of course there were houses, they were not apartments, but I feel like there is the smaller scale, it's also interesting, and I don't know, the observation is even more careful. You can really notice the details in the houses, and you can
Did it feel threatening to you?
No, I mean it's curiosity mostly.
Uh-huh,
I,
uh-huh.
But it's different, of course. But I don't know. It's not threatening because there was nothing happening really. Something could be happening.
Oakland is really interesting, of course.
I mean, but what I meant to say is that there's noir in Oakland. I mean, there is like, and there is crime fiction in Oakland as well. And there is a lot of genre fiction coming out from Oakland. And
film lately, there's been a lot of really good filmmakers, even, you know, guys like Boots Riley making a new series that just premiered, I think, on Amazon called I Am Virgo, that's set in Oakland. Lots of really, really interesting stuff. Oakland has changed also a lot in the past 10 years, I say. And some of those changes are not great. There's a sense of danger now, going out at night, shootings on the freeway, things that didn't happen when you used to live in this area. But we also have those microcosms, wealthy white people living up on the hills, Mexicans, Latinos living in East Oakland, poor black people, and now gentrified neighborhoods in West Oakland. And that always surprised me ever since I came to the Bay Area from Mexico City almost 40 years ago, that there was so much segregation. And people never called it segregation, but that's what it was. You know, when I used to live in Berkeley, I distinctly remember, this was 1986, and I met someone who asked me, where did I live? I said, Berkeley. And they said, oh, I thought you live in East Oakland. I was like, that didn't make any sense to me. I mean, why?
Oh, boy.
And then I figured someone told me, I mean, I wasn't told the reason, but someone told me, oh, because you're Mexicans and Mexicans live in West Oakland. And that notion was so foreign to me and so bizarre and so strange that you had to live somewhere because you happen to be from, you know, some kind of ethnicity or national background. And that's still pretty much going on in Oakland, in Berkeley, in San Francisco, I'm sure in New York, you know, that there is this kind of segregation that we don't own. We try to to stay away from that way of making sense of reality, but it's there regardless.
No, yeah, for sure, for sure.
That also happened. No,
gentrification,
Mexico, but in a different way, right? Mexico City is not. Well, you know, we also claim that we're not racist, that class is more important, but of course we're very racist in Mexico. And poor brown, dark indigenous people don't live in places where white people live.
And this very cheerful note.
Yeah.
We have to segue into our recommendations for the FDF list, Try at Your Own Risk.
We haven't covered the topic. Let's do another hour. Come on.
Guillermo, what do you have for us?
Well, I wanted to recommend not even the whole book, just the intro to The Bridge by Hart Crane, called To the Brooklyn Bridge, which I think is probably the most beautiful poem ever written about a bridge. And it is, I think that people don't have this as a reference usually for New York, but I think that because it is, the whole book is very difficult to read. Hart Crane was a very difficult poet, very cryptic. But just the intro, his description of the Brooklyn Bridge is, I think it's beautiful. And I think people would enjoy it a lot.
Wow.
Cool. Very cool. Thank you. Lobo. Yeah.
I just walked across the Brooklyn Bridge with my family last week. It's really great experience. I'm not going to recommend any books. What I'm doing lately on my free time is I'm watching again all the old episodes of Black Mirror. And it's just fantastic.
You watch them to relax.
Well, I just forgot how great they were back when I watched them the first time. Like I watched them but never watched them again. So I'm just going back to watch all the seasons. And man, they're ominous and brilliant and so well written. And they have become more and more pertinent with the passing of time. I don't know how many years it's been since they 10, maybe 8, 10 years, something like that. But it's scary how right these episodes were about so many things that have to do with the relationship with technology, which I become I'm just so worried about artificial intelligence and everything that we're doing with technology. I just wish I didn't have anything to do with that, but it's too late. How about you, Tim?
My recommendation is something I think you might have recommended a while ago. You did recommend the writer. I'm not sure if you recommended this book, but it's Mariana Enriquez. And it's her book, Our Share of Night, which I just started reading. I'm not that far into it, but I'm already, whoa, I need to have more time and sit down and read more. It's fantastic so far. And it's scary, supernatural, and really creepy in the sense really that when you put it down, you feel not quite safe and secure in your house anymore, or wherever you tend to read it, that maybe the laws that govern our everyday are more complex than we usually think. So it's lovely. It's a lovely read, Our Share of Night. Thank you so much, Guillermo, for coming onto the show.
No, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Our music is by Springtide. It's the Coney Island Train Blues, and it comes to us via the Free Music Archive. Thank you so much for listening. And try us again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye, everybody.